dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World. That was Sarita singing Sonny and Frank Sinatra introducing me. The night he brought me on the Tonight Show. Once again, America's most ballyhooed bread and circuses event, the Not-So-Super Bowl, is over. And from the few minutes I saw, it would have had to improve to be a disaster. After last year's fraudulently won Super Bowl, which the NFL sadly let stand, I literally stopped watching football. I avoided yesterday's also, but I accidentally tuned into the last 5 minutes. It was the 3rd and 9 for Carolina Deep. Their quarterback is stripped of the ball, has a chance to recover, but chooses his safety instead, allowing the Broncos to recover and score. It was the most cowardly sporting act I have ever seen in either amateur or professional sports. I mean, how pathetic. The two best moments of the entire day had nothing to do with football. It was the singers. Lady Gaga, surprisingly making the national anthem sound like it might be a decent song. And Beyonce was wonderful. And speaking of wonderful, we are going to have a wonderful show tonight and probably the most interesting we have ever done, because it's about the umbilical cord that nourishes or malnourishes our culture and the world. Television. The greatest review of television that I ever heard was from Gary Deeb, the brilliant critic of the once outstanding Chicago Tribune. Gary said in the 1970s, television is the only product in America where competition does not improve the product. When I created Real People in 79, there were only 3 networks. Now there are hundreds, and for the most part, more straws in the same septic tank. And my once friend Roger Ailes, president of Fox News, says it's not what you put on the news that matters. It's what you don't put on, which makes news now even less relevant than wrestling. Now I have a few quick observations on the growth of television, why it was once so often littered, informative, and truly funny in the beginning, and no longer is. In the late 40s and early 50s, the makers of television sets had this box. In it was a tube which would broadcast pictures. Now, in order to sell the box, the manufacturers had to have something to put on the tube that would compel people to watch and then buy. In the beginning, most of these boxes were just placed in department store windows. People would gather on the street to watch. The builders of these boxes knew people loved first to be entertained and second informed. So they hired all the proven entertainers and public speakers around. They came from Broadway, burlesque, radio, later movies and newspapers and given shows. Milton Berle, Uncle Milty, became Mr. Television. People now wanted to get off the sidewalk and sit in their own living room, so they began to buy the boxes, even though they were just black and white, by the millions. In a couple of years, Uncle Milty was bumped off of first place by an articulate cleric, Bishop Sheehan. Discovering talkers also sold boxes, now put in the tubes, the best talkers the boxes would ever have, with the likes of Ed Merle, Charles Collingwood, Alastair Cook, David Susskind, and Jack Parr. Then came color and Ed Sullivan and Lucille Ball, and a dozen wonderfully written and performed sitcoms. And on daring live television, the brilliant plays of Rod Serling and Patty Chayefsky, never to be equaled gems like Twilight Zone. And then the trend-shattering, socially relevant, never to be duplicated again, All in the Family. The makers were now selling their boxes like M&Ms by the millions. Families no longer had one box, they now had 2 or 3 or 4 with kids watching their own. Around the dinner table, if they ever gathered anymore, the conversation only came from the box. Then the advertisers, the snake oil salesmen of our nation, moved in. At first, makers of cars, which were unsafe, and sellers of cigarettes that killed you, or pharmaceuticals that drugged and addicted you, bought just a few minutes of commercials. Then they began selling products by the million, and to ensure this profit, they decided to produce their own shows. Then came reality television. With this, writers and performers and talent were no longer needed to fill the boxes. All that was needed for this genre today was for the participants to have no sense of shame or embarrassment. With so many millions of boxes being sold with their now technological improvements, there was no need for them to have any meaningful content. So now, for the most part, they're back to where they started. Empty boxes with remote controls. In John Kennedy's favorite musical, Richard Burton sings and says, "There once was a brief, shiny moment called Camelot. Television was like that when my guest was its dominant creative force. And always, especially at his peak, he put his creativity and his cash where his conscience was in creating people for the American way. If there were a Mount Rushmore for those talents that contribute to our society and culture, his would be the first head up there. As a citizen and creative force, he has won every imaginable prize and award possible. But what he has won the most is our hearts and minds. All you need to hear to be thrilled he is here is a few show titles and a name. The show titles, All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, and the name, Norman Lear, King Lear. Norman, thank you so, so much for being here this evening.
You are welcome, and that was a terrific introduction. I mean, all of the words having nothing to do with Norman Lear. An interesting op-ed. I loved it.
I'm sure they brought back a lot of memories to you, though, when you were a kid in the 50s. And, you know, I must tell you, Norman, it must be serendipity. I watch book TV on the weekends. That's my favorite. But the other night I was sort of walking by the TV set, and on PBS was this wonderful show that my wife watches all the time about people's ancestry. And I sat down for the hour, watched you, and absolutely loved looking at you. Oh, by the way, are you wearing your trademark hat?
I am wearing my hat, really, without it.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. Anyway, you had your hat on, and you were talking about your Bubba and your childhood. Would you please tell us some of those stories, what it was like for you growing up like that back east?
Well, you know, even this I get to experience. That's the title of the book that brought attention to Professor Gates, and he invited me to do... look up my ancestry. But, my father went to prison when I was 9 years old. And he was gone for 3 years. My mother and my sister kind of disappeared. I didn't know where they were. I was sent off to live with an uncle here and an uncle there, and finally with my grandparents. But the night that my father was taken, or the night he was taken away, my mother was selling the furniture. She had already decided to move out of the house. I wasn't going to camp anymore. I was holding in my hand the tape she was going to sew into clothes that I was taking to camp. Norman M. Lear, Norman M. Lear, Norman M. Lear. And in that condition, they're selling the furniture. My father's gone. I'm going to be shipped off. Some fool who was there to look at the furniture put his hand, some older guy put his hand on my 9-year-old shoulder and said, "Well, Norman, you're the man of the house now." And a moment later, we're saying, there, man of the house doesn't cry.
Oh, sad.
And I guess that had to be the moment that I understood the foolishness of the human condition.
What
that
did your father go to?
Ass is telling me I'm at 9 years old. I'm the
Norman. What did your father go to prison for?
He was attempting to sell some fake bonds.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So now you're 9 years of age, so where do you end up if your father's in prison? And your mother's...
I went to an uncle, a third uncle, and then finally my grandparents, my mother's parents.
Did they make sure that you went to school, and where did you go?
No, I went to school, and my grandmother turned out to be the person in my life that I knew loved me. had no problem showing her love. And I don't mean by smothering me with kisses. I mean, she just vibrated her love. You know, she...
On the show, I think you referred to her as Bubba.
Bubba, Jewish grandmother, Bubby and Bubba.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I mean, it was just an absolutely wonderful show. And
my grandfather was the guy who used to hold me by the hand and take me to... we had lots of parades in those days. The 4th of July were parades. The President's Day. There wasn't a President's Day. There was Lincoln's Day, Lincoln's birthday, and George Washington's birthday separated. And
my son, who just finished writing Gary Sinise's new show, Criminal Minds, said, "Dad, you've got to see Norman's documentary. They have a documentary out about Norman at Sundance. Is that true?"
Yes, it opened the Sundance Film Festival a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Will it be released theatrically?
It's going to be released theatrically in June, yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Norman Lear, Just Another Version of You.
Oh, how wonderful. Oh, my God.
That's my bumper sticker. They got it from my bumper sticker. My bumper sticker reads, Just Another Version of You.
Why do you say Just Another Version of You? You're sort of implying that you're just like anybody else, but you're not just like anybody else.
But I am. I'm my own person, but I'm like everybody else, just like they're like me.
Well, you know, maybe emotionally, but intellectually, I mean, my goodness gracious.
Well, we're all different in that way, but we are versions, I use that word, of each other.
Well, I imagine that's true. It's like snowflakes, I guess. It's all snow, but every snowflake is...
No, two snowflakes alike. Yeah, well, that's the way. I couldn't believe anything more when it comes to, let's get to God. When it comes to God... No two snowflakes, no two compacts with the Almighty, with Jesus, with God, with Buddha, whatever one elects to call that entity or think of that entity. No two compacts are alike.
Well, when I interviewed Bob Hope years ago, he said, you know, people always marvel at his longevity, like they might also marvel at yours. He said, but John, what you don't realize is I failed a lot and I struggled a lot. People don't even know that. I lasted a long time because I failed a long time. Tell us how you ended up getting into television, because I know you moved west, I think, with your young daughter early on in your life.
Yes. I have six children. My daughters, by the way, range from twins who are 21 to 68.
You have a 68-year-old daughter?
Yes, I have five daughters.
I can't ask you what she does. She's probably a grandmother by now. But why did you come west, and why with your daughter?
I came west because I was a kid of the Depression. I had one uncle who used to flick me a quarter. Every time he saw me, three or four times I saw him, he flicked me a quarter. I couldn't get over it. I wanted to be what he was. He was a press agent. I didn't even know what it was when I was a kid. But he was my single role model, an uncle who could flick a quarter. That's what I wanted to be. So... I came out to, I served overseas in the middle of my tour of duty in the 15th Air Force. In Foggia, Italy, I stood over a printer and picked letter for letter and wrote this one page projection of Norman Lear's getting out of the service shortly. He's looking for a job in publicity. It was a, you know, he's got his thoughts roll like, I don't know, it was a lot of horseshit. but it was good. And it caught the attention. I sent it to my Uncle Jack, who was still a press agent. He sent it out to a number of houses, press agents. And two of them, one of them offered me a job sight unseen because I was, had served, and the other one was an audition. And I took the sight unseen job, and I was a press agent in New York immediately after I got out of the service. And then I was fired.
Why were you fired?
I was fired because, as a press agent, I wrote what I thought were witticisms or funny situations for our clients. We had Morris Hart, who was a famous playwright, and Kitty Carlisle.
Oh, yes. F1.
Was a famous singer and actress. They were clients, and one day I wrote, and a columnist by the name of Dorothy Kilgallen printed. Morris Hart was gifted by Kitty Carlisle. Morris Hart was gifted by Kitty Carlisle with a pocket flask measured to his hip while he napped. So somebody must have said to Kilgallen, what the hell are you, who is it? How did you happen? Because she printed it.
That's
she called
funny.
My boss, and she wanted me fired. And instead of firing me, I was getting $40 a week. He took me down to $35.
That's wonderful.
But, well, John, just 3 weeks after, a month or so after that, I wrote another a column item, which Kilgallen also printed. This that we had a show we represented on Broadway called Are You With It? And it was a review. You don't see that many reviews today.
No
story, just one act after another and music and such. And one of the acts was Buster Shaver and his midgets. And the lead midget was named Olive. And I wrote and Kilgallen printed that Buster Shaver was seen shopping Fifth Avenue, he on foot, she on a St. Bernard. And this time I was fired.
Oh, you didn't go down to $30 or $25?
No, Kilgallen wanted me out of there.
Okay, so you obviously had this enormous wit, which I almost hate to bring this up, but it's such true. I mean, wit is also a defense mechanism, and God, who needs more defense than Jews for most of the time? But you move west, and you got this sense of humor, you got your daughter in tow. When you get to the west, you end up somehow becoming a writer. How did that happen?
Well, I met this fellow, Ed Simmons, who had come in pretty much the same situation with his wife, who was my cousin. I didn't know her all that well, but she was my cousin, and I looked her up when we got there. Her husband was selling door-to-door during the day and writing at night, hoping to sell something. One night, our wives went out to a movie. We wrote something together, a parody to an ancient song called The Sheik of Araby.
Oh, my.
And the girls came home around 10 after 10 or something like that. We went out to a nightclub and we sold $40. Which $20 for me was a third of what I made in a good week. So we started to write at night, and that's how we started.
Oh, that's so wonderful. But before you met Bud Yorkin, you probably had, I think, one or two other partners, and you did a couple of other shows.
Simmons was my only partner before Bud Yorkin.
And then how did you meet Bud, and why did you and Bud
team
up?
Well, Eddie and I did, our first job was the something called the Jack Haley. He was the wizard, the Tin Man, rather, in the Wizard of Oz. And we did two shows for him that were on the network. There were only three networks, of course. And Jerry Lewis saw a sketch we did and said, I want those guys on. he was coming on television. He and Dean were coming on television, the Colgate Comedy Hour. And within a month of our first job, we had a job with Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, which when they hit on television, we, all four of us went to the moon.
Well, it was monstrous. And Bud, one afternoon, he told me that that's where the telethon started, that you and Bud, evidently...
That was all Bud. That was all Bud. His sister worked for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. She talked to Bud. Bud talked to Jerry. And Jerry did a telethon, and that lasted for, I don't know, 15, 20 years.
My goodness gracious. Okay, now let's get to All in the Family. Because the first time you, I think maybe the first couple of times that you did it as a pilot, was it done at CBS? Was it done someplace else?
No, it was done the first two times, John, it was for ABC. I did it for ABC, and they were afraid of it, but they had the right to ask me to do it again within a year. They asked me at the end of a year. I did it again, same leads. Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton, two different young couples. And then they didn't pick it up after the second time. And a year later, I had gone out and made a film I'm very proud of called Cold Turkey.
Wonderful movie.
And I was, thank you, and I was editing that when CBS called with a new president, Robert Wood, and he said, I want that show on the air. I said, I wouldn't do another pilot. He said, well, we'll make that show. It was the same script, by the way, each and every time.
Was Carol your first choice for Archie Bunker?
He was, I saw other actors. Among them, a conversation, I didn't see him, but a funny conversation with Mickey Rooney.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
I was looking at actors in New York, and I had this Mickey Rooney thought. And I called his manager, who I knew very well. And the manager said, wait a minute, you got an idea for Mickey? He's here. He happens to be in the office. I said, don't put him on. I'm coming to California in a few days. I'd rather tell him this idea in person, because I didn't want to tell him he was a bigot and such. So he said, the phone, he told Mickey, he said, no, he wanted to talk to me. I had never met the man. He got on the phone, he referred to himself in the third person.
Oh,
he
my
said,
goodness.
Norm, you got the mic. What do you have for him? And I said, Mickey, I'm going to be there in a few days. Can I meet with you? I'd rather tell you this idea. No, you got an idea for the mic. He's ready for it.
God.
I said, well, he's a bigot. He'll say these things. Norm, he said, they're going to kill you. They're going to shoot you dead in the street. Now, you can never forget what follows. So I did. He said, you want to do a show for the Mick? Listen to this. Vietnam vet, private eye, blind, short, large dog.
That is so funny. Oh, my God. When it became the monster hit, did he call you back?
No, I never. But, well, we did something together years later. I did a show called A Year at the Top, and he was in it. It lasted two or five shows or something.
Now, was the character of Archie Bunker patterned a little bit after your father or your uncle or any of your relatives?
Well, my dad used to call me the laziest white kid he ever met. So I would scream at him. He didn't need to put a whole race of people down to call me lazy. I'm doing, and you're the dumbest white kid I ever.
Oh my God, that is wonderful. Now the first when it first got on the air, though, while it got really nice reviews, it didn't seem to get a large audience in the beginning. It was like, I don't think it made it till over the summer, right? During rerun.
Well, happily we were We were not on at the early in the season. January 11th or something like that was our start start date. Had we started early on, I don't think it would have been picked up. But what happened with the January start was that when we got to May, and the other two networks were going off the air, we still had a couple of shows to go. So there was some word of mouth out there, and people went to it to see it for the first time. The ratings started to tick up, and at the last minute, we were picked up.
Well, all of America stopped to watch that show. And at the time also, CBS, I believe, had the Smothers Brothers on the air. Did you have any difficulties at that time? Because you were stirring up so much stuff with that show, as were the Smothers. Did you have any problems with standards and practices or with Robert Wood calling you and say, hey, can Carol ease it up a little bit?
Yeah, no, we have a lot of that. That never ceases. It didn't cease. It continues today from everything I hear from people.
Okay, now I'm going to have two other questions, because a number of them. First of all, you're so busy doing that show. Then you come up with Sanford Sud. Red Fox. Red Fox was my one and only friend for my entire life in show business. When
is
I started,
that right?
Yes, he would. He was my mentor when I started as a stand-up. As a matter of fact, I was the second person to put him on television. The first, as you know, was Jack Parr's announcer, Hugh Downs, on the Today Show. But when I got my local variety show in L.A., I had him on the show, and he got the biggest single laugh I ever heard in television. Now you come up with Sanford and Son, then you come up with that brilliant mod with B. Arthur, who I heard, and I think your wife said, bragged about the fact that she was the role model for B. Arthur in that show. Is that true?
No, but B. Arthur, you know, if you saw her in MAME on Broadway.
Yes.
You saw this big, strong, with the guy, the station owners who didn't want to buy the show when it went into syndication called her a ball buster. So they didn't want that ball buster. Anyway, B was a big, tough personality, and that's what we wrote to.
Well, how on earth, Norman, can you find the time to do three number one shows where the writing is constantly brilliant? I mean, it's tough
I didn't do this alone. I had all the help in the world. I had great collaborators, and eventually strong business associates. It's a Terry Parenchu and an Alan Horn in my life.
Yes, I remember. I remember both of them. Didn't you guys start a company called TAT?
First it was Tandem Productions,
right.
and then TAT.
Yeah. What does the TAT stand for?
That's stood for a Yiddish expression, tuchus af in tish. Put your ass on the table. You know, your ass is on the line.
That is so wonderful. Okay, now, your show becomes a hit. And I say this because I told Schlatter, when I told him I wouldn't do the show unless I got a piece of it, and he said to me, this shit isn't going anywhere. I said, then you have nothing to lose if you give me a piece. And, of course, it became the number one show on television for a couple of years. But as always happens, as it did in
the show. Did you have your piece?
Yes, I had my piece. It kept me in greens fees for a long time. But the point is that some of the stars begin to think that they are really talents and that they really are stars. Now, did this happen with Carol? I don't imagine it would happen with Jean Stapleton. That somehow she struck me as different. But did you have problems when you became a hit dealing with stars who kept demanding more?
Well, not demanding more, just demanding. Carol O'Connor in that role comes along once every three centuries.
Yes.
I mean, I kiss his feet. While we had a very difficult time together, I worship him.
Well, I know when Red was having trouble at Sanford, if you, over that damn window for a dressing room or something. He hit, yeah. He hit out at our house on Foreman Avenue, for crying out loud.
No
and
kid.
I told him to go back there and just take whatever. I think you were paying him like $25,000 a show or something. I said, go back there and kiss their ass and thank them. You are the biggest black star in history, for crying out loud.
You know, he wanted the dressing room you're talking about. He wanted a dressing room with a window.
That's it.
Now, there were a string of star dressing rooms at NBC at that time. All of them inside dressing rooms. There were no windows in dressing rooms.
The building was constructed. Reds. Success went to his nose, but God, when he was doing that show with you, he was wonderful.
Yeah, he was.
Norman, we never advertise that we take phone calls, but people are so anxious to talk to you. There's a fellow calling from California. I have no idea what his question is, but he's desperate to talk to you. Do you mind if I bring him
sure.
have him ask you a question?
Sure.
Okay. Don, would you put the caller on, please?
Hello. This is actually the producer, Mike.
Yes, Mike.
Kim.
Go ahead.
And actually, we got when Mr. Lear was announced as a guest, we had a call. We had an audience member who wanted to ask a question but couldn't do so by phone because of trouble. This caller is Hadding in Florida, and he says, "Mr. Lear, in my sociology class, my professor said that studies showed that a great many Americans actually watched All in the Family because they agreed with Archie Bunker's bigoted point of view. Mr. Lear, what, if anything, did you do to address that?"
Well, the interesting thing is, of course, we received a lot of mail, but I can tell that person that I never received a letter from anybody who was saying, "Right on, Archie, God bless Archie," who didn't in a P.S. or some other way say, But you son of a bitch, why don't you drop dead or something?
Okay, Norman, let me ask you this, and because it seems to me the world is in much more horrendous shape now, as is the country, than it was when you were putting Carol on the air with your wonderful show. Why do we not have a sitcom that addresses the subjects that are on everybody's mind today? Why could we not have a contemporary All in the Family?
Well, I think you do have it in South Park, and
that's a cartoon series.
Well, but they get to they're serious writers with serious things on their mind, and they get to all these things.
Take a look at
Carmichael. That's a new show, an all black cast, and they get to it. They dealt with Cosby one week. They dealt with death the next week. They really get into it.
What network is it on? I've never heard of it. It's called Carmichael?
The Carmichael Show.
And is it a sitcom?
It's a sitcom. It's done in front of a live audience just the way we used to do it.
On what network?
On FX, maybe.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Thank you for the heads up. I will certainly...
Oh, take a look at it. Take it. They really get to it. They have some very funny performers, and they are very serious people.
Do you still travel the country with your Bill of Rights?
I still travel the country with my book.
And the book is called?
And the book is called Even This. Like this conversation, I get to experience.
Okay, now, how long has the book been out?
It's been out a year. It just came out in paperback a few months ago.
Okay, now, it's out in paperback. Where can people go to buy the book?
They can take their cell phone and go to Amazon right now. If there's a bookstore left in their community, I would favor that and encourage them to go to the bookstore.
Well,
but the chances are so many bookstores are closed across the country.
Oh, yeah. I used to go to Borders all the time. I was crushed when they closed.
Yeah,
Barnes & Noble is the only one left here in Las Vegas. Norman, I just want to thank you so, so much for your being here.
Oh,
and honest
pleasure,
to God,
John.
The enormous contributions that you have made to this culture and to this country and the things you're continuing to do, we will get to see the documentary when it comes out. Give us again the name of the documentary, which comes from your bumper sticker, and repeat again the name of the book for us.
The documentary is Norman Lear. Norman Lear, Just Another Version of You. We are versions of one another. The book
is even this. Norman, again, thank you. Thank you so much. And thank your
John
staff.
John Barber, thank you and all your listeners.
Well, thank you so much, Norman. And just have a wonderful, wonderful week.
Can I close with my favorite expression?
Yes, please.
This is going to grow on you, John.
Okay.
To be continued.
Oh, how great. But I'll tell you, that's not as good as T-A-T.
To be continued.
Lashona Toba, Tika Tebu.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye, Norman. Thank you so much. We'll be right back with the best co-host anybody could ever have on any radio show, Joe Satilli. Be right back.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film, based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'd like to thank George Knack for that wonderful unsolicited review. Go to Amazon if you want the most definitive documentary ever about the murder of John F. Kennedy. It is The Last Word on the Assassination. Go up there. You'll find 100 unsolicited reviews. A great little book that we did called John Barber's First Facebook Book. Right now, just somebody I could not do this. Imagine doing this show without. Oh, yeah. The first person I couldn't do without is my wonderful producer, whom I've never met. His name is Mike Kim. He lives in Glendora, California. We would not have Norman Lear and Ed Asner if it were not for Mike Kim. So thank you to Mike. But now, I think the brightest man in America is Chris Hedges. I always say that. But if there's a second brightest person, it is the man who puts together this definitive newsletter called News Vandal. And you should not be without it. You can start every morning, look at 10 or 15 or 20 great headlines, read the stories. And it's so objective, it's brilliantly researched and written. And I just love the fact that he comes on my show every time I have a show. Joe Satilli, Joe in California. Joe, welcome to the show. And I hope you love listening to Norman, because like you, I just love people like that. And I love talking about television.
Well, in spite of your effusive introductions of me, there is no way after listening to Norman Lear again, and I've listened to a number of interviews, but this was my favorite so far, that I could ever be considered the first, second, third brightest man in America. Norman Lear is obviously at the top of that list. And the thing that strikes me about Norman Lear is that he is so incredibly humble, where he should not be humble. There is no reason for that level of humility based on this man's accomplishments. You know, John, as you know, I am a child of television, and I collect old TV guides, and I look through those TV guides like some people look through family albums. Some of my first memories are watching the Flip Wilson show when I was 3 years old, watching Sonny and Cher, all the great variety shows. I remember watching All in the Family. My father actually had a mug that had Archie Bunker for president on it, a beer mug, a beer stein. And, you know, when you when I was growing up, I really did watch a lot of television, and I would watch the closing credits. And, for example, watching the great – every production company had their sort of closing credits graphic sort of trademark. Mary Tyler Moore had the cat that went meow.
Oh, that's right, the spoof on MGM.
Yeah, on MGM, right? And so I remember seeing that TAT. And so now that I know the story, that it's about putting – it's basically put your ass on the line in Yiddish. They those kinds of inside jokes where they just – they must have laughed about it a number of times. And all of America just wondered, well, TAT, maybe it just stands for two people – you know, three people's names or whatever. No. Put your ass on the line in Yiddish. It is so classic, and it is such a classic joke by Norman Lear, who, by the way, I think also is responsible for my lifelong obsession and affinity for feisty redheads putting Bonnie Franklin on the air in One Day at a Time. I mean, this guy has affected so many people's lives, and what people do not know is the kind of effect that People for the American Way, his organization that he started in 1981, the kind of effect that organization has had and the imprint that has had on politics often quietly over the course of the last 25, 30 years.
Yeah, well, you know, the Declaration of Independence that he has, he paid $8.1 million for it. It's one of the originals, and he traveled around the country with it. I mean, I knew a few people who were owners of hit shows who had millions and millions of dollars. They never once did anything for anybody except for themselves. And Norman has spent the last 40 years just doing this for everybody. It's just wonderful.
And that's why I said his humility is completely unwarranted. And that's actually what makes him the gem and the national treasure that he is that in spite of all these accomplishments, he's done exactly what you've said you just described he has done. And the fact that he remains, what is the bumper sticker? You know, he's basically saying, I'm no different than you. And it's really quite an amazing thing to come from somebody with the kind of success in the medium, as you pointed out in your excellent introduction, in the medium that has so distorted Americans' sense of themselves because of reality television and our celebrity obsessions.
Oh, gosh, that is so true. Now, he mentioned this show, Carmichael, which I will certainly watch because he said the show took on Cosby, which I think is terrific, and it talks about topical events, but it's on FX. That's sort of a cable station. Why do you think... Because my son told me, he said, and I didn't want to embarrass Norman by asking him, my son told me that he's developed another show that he's having a difficult time selling. I mean, who would not buy something from Norman Lear? But why do you think there is not a contemporary white person show on network television, let's say the three networks? Why, or if you consider Fox and maybe a sort of a major network, why do we not have an All in the Family that is 2016?
Yeah, you know, I think – I haven't seen the Carmichael show. I think it actually might be on NBC. So it does get network play. But here's the thing. NBC and FX, it really doesn't matter anymore, John, because if you look at where the big hit shows are, it's Orange is the New Black. It was Sopranos on HBO. There's such fragmentation. Now, the last show, it seems to me, as a student and child of history, the history of television, that the last show like that that you're talking about was the Roseanne show, where you had a – it was a sitcom. It was white working class.
That's true.
Right? They kind of – Roseanne seemed to have rebooted on some level that model that Norman Lear started. But I think a lot of what it is – and you know, maybe the Carmichael show, and I think this is the point you're making, saying why there wasn't a white people show, that for other groups to be able to go ahead and replicate those models, there's more traction or play because black folks or minority folks have not had the same opportunities in television that white folks have had. So now that they get that opportunity, there's an attraction and there's a pull to that because they can finally say the things that they were never allowed to say on television. Now, I think part of the problem, though, with all of this, John, is cynicism. I think the audience is cynical. I think the audience is hard to shock. And one thing about All in the Family that I do remember in real time as a child is that every week it was water cooler fodder. I mean, people got around the water cooler and they talked about what happened on All in the Family because it was shocking the sensibilities of the entire nation. And also, John, you can explain to people what the difference is between audience share then and now. I think there was a time at which All in the Family, something like 60% of all the televisions in America were watching All in the Family. I mean,
yes,
staggering numbers.
It had a profound impact. I would like to touch on a couple of other things because your news vandal is so good and it's such a source of wonderful information. Can we – I hate to go – but since some of our television sets are manufactured in Korea.
Yeah.
Tell us about what is going on in Korea that we should be aware of.
Well – you know, we had the Super Bowl, and as you mentioned, it was something of a dud. I watched it soup to nuts, and it was – I actually think that maybe this might be the beginning of the end of the Super Bowl. I hate to say something like that because it has such a pull, but the commercials were flaccid. The game was dull. The whole presentation outside of Beyonce's ode to the Black Panthers was pedestrian. But one of the things that happened – there were two things that happened there. One – and this is something that made the rounds, is it really does seem like it's becoming a unofficial holiday to celebrate American militarism.
That is so true.
And the other thing that happened is that a North Korean satellite is reputed to have flown over the stadium. Now, when you say satellite flew over the stadium, we're talking about low orbit in the upper atmosphere. And so technically it did go over the stadium and how ominous that is. And it's funny that that is being pitched as a story today in the news cycle within, you know, 16 hours of North Korea launching another missile, a test missile. And there is now this ominous feeling that intercontinental ballistic missiles could reach the United States. And so now the United States is scrambling with the South Koreans to put THAAD, that's THAAD, THAAD, anti-missile defense in South Korea. Of course, the Chinese are very upset with this. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring all this up is because this is a really profitable opportunity for the military-industrial complex.
Oh, my God.
And it really does remind me of – do you remember when it was called Star Wars under Ronald Reagan?
Yes, yes.
Now, the whole Star Wars thing is that in theory it might have worked – but it turned – really the Reagan administration – I'll give this to Ronald Reagan because on no matter what you want to say about Ronald Reagan, I can say a lot of bad things. He actually did want to end the Cold War. He did want to come to a conclusion of the Cold War with the Russians, and he was very close to ending the Cold War at Reykjavik with Gorbachev. But Richard Perle, who went on to become one of the men behind the Second Iraq War, said, "Don't do that, Ronnie," and he was convinced not to. But missile defense – one of the things about missile defense that you have to keep in mind as it progressed through the 90s, and it really, when the Soviet Union fell, there was kind of a sense of, well, why do we need missile defense now? We're not worried about Russian missiles. They're the only missiles that could reach us. And now if we're in, you know, if we're in a denouement, what's the point? Well, what happened was, is that there's a guy who was a big donor, I think to the tune of about $100,000 to the Democratic Party. And he was the head of Loral Space. Now, Loral Space was it's space and communications. The CEO's name was Bernard Schwartz, and in 1994, right, he went with Ron Brown to China and cut a deal with the Chinese. And guess what the Chinese got? They got these interesting little gyroscopes. And the Chinese, their ICBMs weren't working.
Well, then all of a sudden,
their ICBMs.
Is this the Ron Brown, Clinton's Ron Brown?
Clinton's Ron Brown. And so all of a sudden. Yes, the plane crash in the Balkans, I believe it was. Well,
with a bullet in his head at the same time?
Well, yeah, there's talk about that. So, I don't have the hard evidence on that, but that is what is definitely reputed. But right. What I do know is that after that deal was made, Bernard Schwartz, $100,000 to the Democratic National Committee, he goes to China. China gets these gyroscopes. All of a sudden, their ICBMs are not dying off of the launching pad. They're working, which means, guess what? The ICBMs can hit America. And guess what? All of a sudden, the missile defense program, which was about to die, gets a lifeline. So they weren't getting the multi-billions, but they were getting $3, $4, $5 billion. And lo and behold, we still have missile defense today. But here's the dirty little secret about missile defense. It's not defense. Missile defense is actually an offensive system. And so now the Chinese are going to make a big stink about this idea of the United States putting these missile defense systems in South Korea, much in the way the Russians are very, very uncomfortable with the missile defense systems that Poland and Hungary and the United States are all getting together to try and put all around Russia. Because what missile defense does is it's not actually a defense system, because the thing about nuclear war that keeps nuclear war from happening, according to almost every theorist who's ever looked at this, is MAD, mutually assured destruction. Well, what that means is that there is no first strike victory. If you launch, by the time they get halfway through their launch pattern, your opponent is going to know they're going to launch a retaliatory strike, and you have mutually assured destruction. But if you have missile defense, you can actually launch an offensive strike and then use missile defense systems to knock down your opponent's retaliatory strike, which in a sense nullifies mutually assured destruction. And if you are right there on the border with China and right there on the border with Russia, you can basically contain any of their counterattacks, and therefore you now have the option of a nuclear first strike.
Oh my goodness gracious. Oh my God.
So I just want to point this out. I worked at the Center for Defense Information, my first job in D.C. as a defense policy researcher. I worked on China at that time. All of D.C. was going nuts about China, 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 China. It was kind of like the Trump campaign, 15 years in advance when I was there in 1999. A lot of it had to do with China getting this ICBM technology that allowed them to launch these missiles through Loral Space and Communications, I think was the name of the company at the time. And also because remember Johnny Chung and all of the back dealings, the money going through the Clinton administration into the Democratic Party.
Well, the horrible thing is that China, there was at one point where they were going to try to sell the harbor in San Diego under Clinton to China, for crying out loud. And here you have that guy's wife being one of the leading candidates to become president of the United States. I mean, that's unconscionable. How did she ever get that far?
Well, because she used to be on the board of Walmart. And who was one of the great beneficiaries of Clinton's opening to China in the 90s? It was Walmart.
Okay, Joe, we have about 60 seconds left. And I want you to tell folks where they can get that absolutely wonderful news, Vandal. When again are you going to be at Chuck's show, and when are you going to be doing your own show? Go ahead.
Yeah, it'll be I'll be on the Ocelli Effect tomorrow night. Ocelli Effect, Ocelli, Ocelli Effect tomorrow night at 6 o'clock for an hour. Well, we'll probably talk about New Hampshire. The simple way to get the rundown Monday through Friday every morning is just to go to newsvandal.com. It's spelled just like it sounds, newsvandal.com. A little box will pop up. You can sign up right there. I got my latest stuff I've written on there too. And John, as ever, it's always a pleasure to be with you. But today, to listen to you laughing and guffawing at Norman Lear was one of the great joys of my life.
Oh, well, thank you, Joe, so much. Honest to God, I just look forward to getting that News Vandal every day. Everybody I know just loves it. And I think I forwarded you a couple of notes from people that I suggest get it, and I hope so.
Very appreciative.
And the article that you're working on, what is that article?
It's called Bankers Say the Darndest Things. It's about this thing that Lloyd Blankfein said last week about worrying about the Bernie Sanders. But there's a little subtle thing going on there that I'm going to try and flesh out by tomorrow morning, and hopefully it'll go up.
Okay, well, thank you so much. We'll be listening to you on the Acelli Effect tomorrow night, and then again on Friday and every day reading your News Vandal. Have a wonderful, wonderful night, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. I think we're going to be having Cynthia McKinney and her son on. Isn't that
excellent.
Terrific? He used to be a lawyer, and he gave it up because he said it was all BS. He gave it up. So anyway, thank you all very much for listening. Joe and I will talk to you in 2 weeks. Have a wonderful night, and good luck to the show that's following us. It's debuting this week, so good luck. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.